This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm Joe Ramsey. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said Sunday he will use the Group of Seven G7 Wealthy Democracies Summit this week to urge world leaders to commit to vaccinating the global population by the end of 2022. Johnson is expected to stress the importance of a global vaccination drive when he meets with fellow world leaders on Friday in Cornwall, England, for the first face-to-face G7 summit since the pandemic hit. He said in a statement Sunday, quote, "Vaccinating the world by the end of next year would be the single greatest feat in medical history." U.S. President Joe Biden and the leaders of Canada, France, Italy, and Japan will arrive in Cornwall from Friday for 3 days of talks focusing on the global recovery from the pandemic. The Sunday Times reports Johnson is set to announce at the summit Britain will pledge to donate over £2 billion worth of jabs this year, with further donations in 2022. The U.S. has said it plans to share 80 million doses of its surplus vaccine globally by the end of June. At least 11 civilians were killed, including 4 women and 3 children, when a roadside bomb struck a bus in Afghanistan, officials said Sunday, as a top U.S. negotiator visited Kabul. The latest attack targeting passenger vehicles occurred on Saturday evening, raising fears of fresh violence in the months ahead as the U.S. military continues to pull out its last remaining troops from the country. No group has claimed responsibility, but the Taliban is accused of planting the bomb. Saturday's attack came after a series of blasts targeted passenger buses in Kabul this week, 2 of them on Thursday. Find more on these stories at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Mexicans head to the polls Sunday to vote for a new lower house of Congress, state governors, and local lawmakers. Races seen as a referendum on President Andrés Manuel López Obrador's policies and efforts to shake up Mexico's institutions. All 500 seats in the lower house, 15 state governorships, and thousands of local leadership positions are up for grabs, with some 93.5 million Mexicans eligible to vote. The lead-up to the elections has been overshadowed by the COVID-19 pandemic and vaccine rollout, as well as record criminal violence, with a security group claiming 91 politicians have been killed in this election cycle. Israeli police arrested a Palestinian protest leader in a contested neighborhood of Jerusalem Sunday, a day after forcefully detaining a prominent journalist there. The Al Jazeera reporter was covering the campaign by Jewish settlers to evict dozens of Palestinian families from the area. She was released from a hospital Sunday with a broken hand that her boss said she sustained Saturday. Al Jazeera's acting director general is accusing Israel of attempting to silence journalists. The tension over evictions helped spark weeks of unrest leading to last month's Israel-Hamas's 11-day war. The most imminent Jerusalem evictions are on hold following the intervention by Israel's attorney general, but the settlers' campaign continues. Pope Francis said Sunday he was pained by the discovery of the remains of 215 children at a former Catholic school for Indigenous students in Canada and called for respect of the rights and culture of Native peoples. He urged Canadian political and Catholic religious leaders to shed light on the finding and seek reconciliation and healing. He stopped short, however, of the direct apology that many Canadians had demanded from the Catholic Church for its role in the residential schools. Last month's discovery of the remains of the children at a British Columbia school, which closed in 1978, is reopening old wounds and fueling outrage in Canada about the lack of information and accountability. The school system forcibly separated about 150,000 children from their homes. Many were subjected to abuse, rape, and malnutrition in what a commission in 2015 called, quote, cultural genocide. And several ceremonies are taking place Sunday commemorating the 77th anniversary of D-Day that led to the liberation of France and Europe from the German occupation during World War II. On June 6, 1944, more than 150,000 Allied troops landed on codenamed beaches carried by 7,000 boats. But for the second year in a row, commemorations are marked by virus travel restrictions due to the pandemic. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey. VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
The country is already tense by virtue of what is happening, the insecurity in this nation, where people are no longer feeling safe. So I expect that what we should be doing now is to do things that will further unite this nation, not something that will further divide us. So I pray that it will not get to that.
A Nigerian lawmaker urges the government to reverse its ban on Twitter operations in the country.
We are in consultation and we are trying to identify who we think that their respective vision of their political party nearly resembles what we stand for, what we believe is.
A Zambian opposition figure promises to soon endorse a presidential candidate capable of defeating incumbent President Edgar Lungu.
That door is open to negotiate for additional interventions to be added and for additional funding to be allocated.
And representatives of the Herero people welcome an agreement between the Namibian government and Germany. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Nigeria, the leader of the minority in the House of Representatives says it's possible some citizens will legally challenge the government's directive suspending the operations of Twitter in the West African country. Ndudi Elumelu also expressed dismay with the directive of the Attorney General and Justice Minister Abubakar Malami seeking to prosecute those who violate the suspension. In a press statement, the minority leader sharply condemned Twitter's suspension, describing it as provocative, obnoxious, unjustifiable, and a clear violation of the freedom of speech and other democratic rights the Constitution guarantees. Supporters of the government say the administration in Abuja took the right decision, arguing that Twitter undermines the country's corporate existence. For the latest development in the government's indefinite suspension of Twitter in Nigeria, I reach Ndudi Elumelu in the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos.
Now, of course, we described the suspension of Twitter in Nigeria as provocative, obnoxious, and justifiable. We also said that we feel that this may smack off intolerance, insensitivity, and the views, opinions, and aspirations of Nigerian citizens, especially the youths. We have the opinion also that this action of federal government coming at this time, when National Assembly is conducting its public hearing towards the amendment of the Constitution, may constitute a major setback capable of diminishing public confidence in the SSI, as well as other processes of genuine efforts by the legislature to strengthen democratic fairness in the country. And we also look at the fact that the fundamental human rights of every citizen of Nigeria is being affected because freedom of expression, freedom to belong to any particular association is being affected by this singular decision.
The Attorney General of the Federation, Abubakar Malami, has directed for the immediate prosecution of offenders of the federal government's ban on Twitter operations in Nigeria. What is your reaction to this directive coming from the Attorney General?
I want to believe that that cannot be coming from him. That's the senior advocate of Nigeria. He knows the law very well. We are not running a military government, and I don't think we should begin to take action that will lead to anarchy in the nation. You know, I want to believe that that is not coming from him. But I want to surely believe that as a senior advocate of Nigeria, he knows better and cannot be involved in such.
Information Minister Lai Mohammed, in announcing the ban of Twitter operations in Nigeria, said they are undermining the country's corporate existence, for which reason the decision was made. Do you think that is justified? Because some people are saying that indeed Twitter is undermining Nigeria's corporate existence, so the decision taken by the Nigerian government is well placed.
Twitter felt justified by comments claiming coming from the president of Nigeria, and that informed why such decision was taken. And I felt that should be personal. There's nothing like corporate existence of Nigeria being affected by the decision of Twitter. It was on personal ground because not all Nigerians, you know, are agreed that Mr. President should open an account with Twitter. He did that on personal basis as an individual, and of course, given that he's the president of Nigeria, of course, he channels most of his activity through Twitter, letting the world know what he does. So I don't think that has anything to do with corporate existence of Nigeria.
Do you think that your call for the government to reverse its action will be adhered to, particularly with the directive given by Attorney General Malami to prosecute the offenders?
We will watch and see what happens. You know, I pray that they will not be wanting to affect individuals or Nigerians who are peace-loving people. The lesson we have learned from EMSAR should be enough for us, you know, and be able to allow the youth to be, because the majority of people that will be so affected are the youth. That may not go well for this nation and for the corporate existence of Nigeria.
What comes next for Nigerians, especially when a lot of people are expressing concern that their fundamental rights as protected by the Nigerian constitution is being abrogated by such an action from the government?
I know that on individual basis, so people will go to court to challenge the decision of federal government. And some people will also, you know, do the needful that will allow the international community to hear that they are being suppressed in their own country. I don't pray that some of these things, the country is already tense by virtue of what is happening, the insecurity in this nation, where people are no longer feeling safe. So I expect that what we should be doing now is to do things that will further unite this nation, not something that will further divide us. So I pray that it will not get to that.
Ndudi Elumelu is the leader of the minority in the Nigerian House of Representatives. He spoke with me from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos. In the Gambia, a two-day conference is looking at ways to improve the judiciary's role in settling electoral disputes. The courts are expected to play a significant part in parliamentary, presidential and local polls in December. For VOA, Pat Nderi Mbai has more from Raleigh, North Carolina.
The registration of voters has begun in the Gambia. As part of the process, the Independent Election Commission has created so-called revising courts. They will settle all election-related disputes, including opposition by political parties to any part of the drive to enroll up to 1 million voters. The objections often center on the citizenship of people applying for voters' cards, their areas of residency, and on violation of the requirement that voters must be at least 18 years of age. Chief Justice Hassan Diallo, who has served as prosecutor for the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, outlines how the new system will operate.
Each revising court will be presided over by a first-class magistrate, and each such court is required to render its decisions within 60 days of the notice of an appeal or objection to any entry in the register. The Supreme Court of the Gambia also has a role to play in the resolution of electoral disputes.
Diallo says the courts have been empowered by law to select citizens who are qualified to vote.
Disputes and challenges are not uncommon in the process of registration of voters and in the various stages which follow and which end ultimately in the conduct of elections. All such disputes should, however, be resolved peacefully and in accordance with the law and with due process.
Aishatu Diallo C is Gambia's judicial secretary. She emphasizes the importance of the court's ethics and independence and is advising all magistrates and judges to avoid any conduct that will render their impartiality questionable.
It is important to bear in mind that as an adjudicator, that an adjudicator must be independent and impartial and must avoid any direct or indirect conflict of interest, impropriety, and must not be influenced by self-interest, outside pressure, political considerations, public clamor, or the fear of criticism.
Incumbent President Adama Barrow registered to vote last Wednesday. He has called on Gambian youths, who make up to 65% of the population, to register as well. The president has also called on citizens to avoid any form of violence during the registration process.
There is a code of conduct that we expect from every political party. Nobody should intimidate anybody. We are all Gambians. We are all equal in this country. That's why everybody, you register once only and you vote once. Even if you are president or you are party leader, that doesn't give you any other extra powers or importance to vote more than once. Your vote is one. So I think that means that shows the equality in democracy.
18 parties have been created since the fall of former dictator Yahya Jammeh, who is now living in exile in Equatorial Guinea. December's polls will be the country's first presidential, parliamentary, and local elections since the vote that ended his rule 5 years ago. Meanwhile, at least 7 people have been arrested for obtaining voters' cards through fraudulent means. The leader of the main opposition, United Democratic Party, Usainu Dabo, has stressed the need for what he calls the transparent and credible registration of voters. He also says foreign nationals should not be allowed to register. The voter registration drive will come to an end on July 11. For VOA News, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
The leader of the Zambian Opposition All People's Congress, or APC, says the group will soon endorse a presidential candidate capable of defeating incumbent President Edgar Lungu in the upcoming August 12 general election. Nelson Nsomni, who failed to meet requirements to compete in the presidential election, blames the Electoral Commission of Zambia for showing bias in favor of the governing Patriotic Front. He denies reports that his party's lack of preparation and popular support were factors in his failure to qualify as a candidate. Zambians go to the polls in August to choose a new president and parliament. Meanwhile, the Electoral Commission has directed political parties not to hold large public rallies as part of the effort to limit the spread of the COVID-19 during the election period. But Nelson Nsomi tells me that opposition parties will disregard the directive, arguing that the electoral body's action only favors the president and his ruling party.
It all started off very well, except that we were supposed to be the first ones, I think, between me and President Lungu, the Patriotic Front, the ruling party. The ruling party was allowed to make adjustments to the timetable, to adjustment to its timetable, and we similarly requested the same. They were allowed to do so. But in our case, the Electoral Commission, the so-called Independent Electoral Commission, did not respond to our letter, email that we wrote to them on the 13th of May. So, in essence, they made it impossible for us to carry out the process, to complete the pre-processing process of our supporters.
Some people are suggesting that you just don't have the people needed to file your nomination and that you are just one of those pocket political parties or presidential aspirants that made noise on social media platforms but doesn't have support on the ground. How do you respond to that?
That's not true. That is not true. That's what they want to believe, that that's the case. But that is not the case. They frustrated our supporters. How come we struggled? We did in 6 provinces, but we couldn't bring the other 4 provinces to Lusaka because they changed the process when the game had already started playing. So they said, you bring all the other supporters to Lusaka. So it was practically impossible to bring those supporters in 2 days' time. Looking at the logistics. So it's not true that we don't have supporters.
Now that it looks like the door is shut, what is your next line of action?
Yeah. Well, we have agreed as a party that we identify a suitable opposition political party and support that political party for purposes of regime change. And I think that's the inescapable political process of this country. Regime change is of the essence if this country is to survive economically.
You are in opposition. You have seen all the opposition political parties. There were even attempts to have an opposition alliance before the elections. You are talking about regime change. Have you identified any specific candidate that has the best shot of defeating incumbent President Edgar Chagwa Lungu?
I think let us be spotlessly clear. Mr. Lungu is the weakest candidate in this election. That's more the reason why he has arm-twisted the Electoral Commission to prevent the opposition from holding rallies, because they don't want to be exposed.
Some people argue that is not true. There's a pandemic, and medical measures have been implemented to ensure that you cut the spread of the coronavirus in Zambia. Nobody is campaigning, so why are you blaming the president for that?
Well, he has never taken the message of COVID-19. Early this year, when probably it was worse than the way it is now, the opposition was consistent in cautioning him and his party to avoid campaigning, but they paid no attention to that message, and they took no notice to the seriousness of the pandemic when it had hit the peak. Now then, the question is why now, when even the statistics themselves are nowhere near to what it was 3 months ago? So we think that this is rather for political expediency and for self-serving. The idea is to gag the opposition. The idea is to suppress and oppress the opposition.
So which of the candidates are you going to endorse or support?
Well, we are still as a party. And when I say as a party, we are also talking about our other allied political parties that we work closely with. We are in consultation, and we are trying to identify who we think that their respective vision of their political party nearly resembles what we stand for, what we believe in.
You have one objective: to defeat incumbent President Edgar Lungu. You have said he is the weakest presidential candidate. So why wouldn't you support the next big thing that you know is capable of winning? So why are you delaying? This is why people are saying that you only exist on paper, but not on the ground. And that is why you are delaying, which affected your candidacy.
Well, first, I think we are all clear that the man's candidature has been challenged, because he has already held office twice.
Nassim Soni is the leader of the Zambian Opposition All People's Congress, or APC. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. In Namibia, representatives of the Nama people have welcomed the agreement signed between the Namibian government and the German government. This, despite the rejection of the agreement by attorney Vikui Rukoru, a chief of the Herero people. He says failure to include reparations as demanded by victims of colonial rule in Namibia is unacceptable. Bafredi Nguvauva, who speaks for the Nama people, says the group is satisfied with the agreement between the two governments. He denies reports that the Nama people were excluded from negotiations which led to the agreement. As part of the settlement, Berlin officially apologized for the genocide against the Nama and the Herero people, which occurred more than 100 years ago. Tens of thousands of Herero and about 10,000 Nama were killed, tortured, or driven into the desert for rebelling against German rule. Local media reports that under the terms of the agreement, Germany will provide 30 years of financial assistance to improve infrastructure, healthcare, and training programs for the two ethnic groups. Freddy Nguvauva tells me that representatives of the Nama people will continue to engage the German government to meet some of the demands not included in the current agreement.
Now, the reaction of the Wabaderu, Waherero, and Nama people that are part of the ONCD committee, they have accepted the deal, the agreement reached between the two governments, because we have been part and parcel of the ongoing negotiations since the negotiations started way back in 2016. We have been part and parcel of the ongoing negotiations. Myself, I have been a representative of these communities on the negotiating table. So as a result of the deal that we concluded almost 2 weeks ago in Berlin, I was also there. And although the amount offered by the German, yes, we do agree that the amount offered is very, very little.
Are you satisfied with the amount that the German government is putting up for the development projects that will help the people?
We are not satisfied fully with the amount. The amount is too little. The amount is too little, but our position is that, you see, the amount is one of the three key aspects that we have been negotiating on. So we were pressing the Germans to acknowledge that they committed genocide against our ancestors. We have been pressing the Germans to apologize to us for the heinous acts of genocide that they have committed against us. So on those two, we are completely very happy that the Germans finally acknowledge that they committed genocide. The German government also undertook to come and apologize officially to us, the affected communities, and the Namibian government. So, and this apology will be tendered by the highest officer in Germany.
I spoke with the paramount chief of the Herero people, Vikui Rukoro, who is of the view that they reject the agreement because one of the key requirements is for reparations to be paid to the people, and that because reparations are not being paid and that only a token has been given by the German government, they reject outright the deal signed between Windhoek and the German government or Berlin. What do you say to that?
Here in Namibia, he is just another chief of like many other chiefs. A recognized chief of the Herero, like all the other recognized chiefs. He's not the only one. He's not the superior one. So that should be understood in that way from the onset. So he has got all the right to reject, and other chiefs have got all the rights to accept, like they did.
So where do things go from here?
Yes, the people from here, we will take what was offered. Yes, it's not enough, and it's very obvious that the door is not yet completely closed. The negotiations will proceed at different angles, and as we are implementing those projects that will be funded, we will continue to impress upon the Germans to ensure that additional funding is allocated to further developmental projects.
So how are you going to continue to engage the government when the agreement has already been signed and dealt with?
Yeah, you see, if you read the agreement carefully, it's making reference to certain interventions that are listed in this agreement. And there are also other interventions that were completely not catered for, that could not be catered for due to the limitations of the of the resources of the allocation. So that door is open to negotiate for additional interventions to be added and for additional funding to be to be allocated. So that agreement, you cannot say, it's not to say that we cannot really go back to negotiations. Yes, but we can still identify some areas, and as we are implementing. This was not a legal thing. We were negotiating on moral, historical, and political grounds.
Freddy Nguvauva is a representative of the Nama people. He spoke with me from the Namibian capital, Windhoek.
is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, female Cameroonian activists and opposition members have appealed to the United Nations Security Council meeting Monday to discuss possible solutions to escalating Boko Haram terrorism and the separatist crisis in the Central African country. They are also asking the UN to force Cameroon to respect human rights, release political prisoners, and negotiate a ceasefire with armed groups. For VOA, Moki Edward Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé, that the government has refused to respond to the appeal.
20 female leaders say in a letter to the United Nations Security Council that Cameroon, once the bastion of stability in Central Africa, is today conflict-ridden and on the brink of catastrophe. They say that more than 10,000 Cameroonians have died in the Boko Haram conflict on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria and the separatist crisis in the Central African states' English-speaking western regions. They accuse Cameroon's government and rebels of gross human rights violations. Edith Kawala is the president of the Cameroon People's Party and founding member of Stand Up for Cameroon, which advocates for a peaceful transition to rebuild Cameroon. She says the women want the Security Council to include Cameroon on their agenda.
We want the UN to give us help now. We don't want them to wait till the situation is so bad and then to start telling us that they are bringing UN soldiers here. We want them to act now. Our population is dying. Over 1 million children are out of school. We cannot sit by as our country falls apart. There is no peace without respect of human rights, without justice.
Walla said the women want the UN to require Cameroon to respect human rights and release all non-violent political prisoners linked to Boko Haram, separatists, and the political crisis in the Central African state. The women say that for the sake of peace, UN member states should ask Cameroon to allow free public discussions on political transition. Cameroon's 88-year-old president, Paul Biya, has been in power for close to 40 years and is accused of wanting to hang on to power until he dies. Ejani Leonard Kulu is a Cameroonian political analyst at the UN University for Peace in Addis Ababa. He says it is very unlikely that the United Nations will take up the female leaders' proposals. He says the United Nations has already helped Cameroon, Chad, Nigeria, Niger, and Benin contribute troops to a joint task force to fight Boko Haram.
The UN is a partner in managing the crisis in Cameroon. If we should take Boko Haram, remember the multinational joint task force. It is financed and supported by the UN. The crisis in Northwest and Southwest, the UN has pronounced itself on several occasions that is an internal problem which Cameroon alone can solve.
Kulu said Cameroon female leaders should have carried out advocacy with the five permanent members of the Security Council, China, France, Russia, the United Kingdom, and the United States to ensure discussion of Cameroon at the Security Council. In another letter, the female leaders asked International Monetary Fund Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva to stop disbursing funds until the Cameroon government shows proof of transparent management. Tumainon Damjoya is mayor of the western town of Fumban, an official of the Cameroon Democratic Union and a former lawmaker in Cameroon's National Assembly.
Nous avons concomitamment saisi le FMI, Fonds Monétaire International, par rapport au financement.
Joya says the female leaders are not indifferent to the high wave of corruption and theft of public funds in Cameroon. She says many government ministers have been asked to explain what happened to a $335 million IMF loan intended to stop the spread of COVID-19. She says it would be unfair to continue to give loans to Cameroon when the government has not accounted for amounts already received. Cameroon government spokesperson René Emmanuel Sadi did not respond when contacted by VOA about Njoya's comments. In a release read on state radio, Cameroon promised to investigate corruption and punish those found guilty. Cameroon, a majority French-speaking country, is facing several problems, including a separatist crisis in its English-speaking western regions and Boko Haram terrorism on its northern border with Nigeria. Cameroon also suffers the spillover of the crisis in the Central African Republic, with attacks by rebels on its eastern border and political tensions from Biya's long stay in power. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The World Food Programme is warning that 21% of Sudan's 40 million population faces acute hunger and will need emergency assistance between June and September when food stocks are lowest. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Several factors have contributed to this situation. For example, over the past year, Sudan has faced hyperinflation, the worst floods in years, a locust infestation, and COVID-19 restrictions, which have caused massive job losses. A nutritional survey by the Sudanese government, the Food and Agriculture Organization, and World Food Program finds 9.8 million people cannot feed themselves, putting many of their lives at risk. The WFP says it will provide food assistance for 9.3 million of the most vulnerable people during the next 6 months. But it is $48 million short of what it needs for this operation and is appealing for support. Marion Ward is the WFP's Deputy Country Director Operations in Sudan. Speaking by video link from the capital, Khartoum, she says the WFP has been expanding its school feeding programs to provide children with nutritional biscuits.
I recently was, you know, very far north of Khartoum, where we were opening and inaugurating a new school to be part of our school feeding program. The school was literally mobbed by children whose families were sending them there so they could at least get one meal a day covered from somewhere else so that the family could, you know, feed them.
Sudan's global acute malnutrition rate, including young children with both moderate and severe acute malnutrition, is 14% at the edge of the World Health Organization's emergency threshold. This is a condition that in some cases can lead to death. Ward says United Nations agencies are expanding nutrition centers across the country.
For the first time ever this last year, WFP began opening nutrition centers, emergency nutrition centers in Khartoum itself. Traditionally, WFP has not had to intervene in the capital because it's the heartbeat of the country and the richest place. But the situation, particularly with hyperinflation, has been so difficult for so many families that indeed it is on a crisis footing right now.
WFP says the cost of hunger to the Sudanese economy is estimated at $2 billion per year, or about 2.6% of its gross domestic product. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impunga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The African Athletics Championships might not be held this year after Nigeria made a U-turn over hosting the event. Nigerian authorities have said the championships cannot be hosted as planned between 23rd and 27th June due to the global COVID-19 pandemic. Just last week, Nigeria had agreed to step in to host the event in Lagos to replace Algeria, who had asked for a postponement, also citing COVID-19. Algeria's decision means the athletics showpiece might not happen this year, despite Algeria insisting it is still willing to host the event later this year, depending on the COVID-19 situation. The Confederation of African Athletics had hoped that with Nigeria hosting the championships, it would give athletes the chance to achieve qualifying standards for the Tokyo Olympics ahead of the June 29th deadline. In football, the Indomitable Lions of Cameroon defeated the Super Eagles of Nigeria 1-0 in the first of their scheduled double-header friendlies in Austria. In other international friendlies, Rwanda defeated the Central African Republic 2-0 at Amahoro Stadium in Kigali on Friday. Amavumbi will play a second warm-up game against the Central African Republic on Monday at the same stadium. Both sides are using the matches to prepare for their respective FIFA World Cup Qatar 2022 qualifiers that begin in September. Rwanda are in Group E alongside Uganda, Kenya and Mali, while the Central African Republic are in Group C with Nigeria, Cape Verde and Liberia. Elsewhere, Ivory Coast beat Burkina Faso 2-1, Mozambique defeated Lesotho 5-0 on Wednesday in Maputo, Algeria beat Mauritania 4-1 on Friday, and Zambia lost to Senegal on Saturday. Meanwhile, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, has banned Tunisia international Taha Yassin Kenissi for 1 year for a doping violation. CAF's disciplinary committee also ruled on incidents involving the Senegalese club Jaraf and Algeria's Mamelodi Alga. Esperance's Kenissi tested positive for a prohibited substance after an African Champions League game against Alga on May 10th. The 29-year-old's ban began on May 19th, and that means he's ineligible to play for Tunisia at January's Africa Cup of Nations finals in Cameroon. There were also 12-month bans for two Mamelodi Alga's players for assaulting the referee during a Champions League fixture against Morocco's Wydad Casablanca. Alga have also been fined $25,000. And two Jaraf players and a club official were sanctioned for assaulting match officials during their Confederation Cup quarterfinal against Cameroon's Cotton Sport on May 23rd. Jaraf official Yosa Dial has been suspended for 2 years from all football activities, while Albert Diani and Mamadou Sylo have been banned for 6 matches. Jaraf will also have to pay $50,000 for the aggressive behavior and improper conduct of their officials and players. Finally, Rwanda has accepted the request from the International Olympic Committee to be a hub offering vaccination services for those traveling to the Tokyo Games. The other center for those needing to be vaccinated ahead of the Olympics will be in Qatar. Rwanda's head of the National Olympic Committee, Uwayo Thiogene, told the media that Rwanda had confirmed to the International Olympic Committee that the East African nation was interested in providing the service for those national federations who might not have the facilities that Rwanda has. Thiogene described the gesture as Rwanda playing her modest role in the successful implementation of the Olympics. He also clarified that the International Olympic Committee will be coordinating the project rather than his National Olympic Committee, and added that Rwanda's plans for the Olympics are going ahead as planned. And that's it for this edition of Netland Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week, there was a rather discordant meeting of the African Union Pan-African Parliament in South Africa. The cause for this disturbance among the parliamentarians was due to the fact that the Anglophone members of parliament were demanding that the Francophone members allow rotation of leadership of the parliament. It turned out that since the Pan-African parliament was established, the leadership has always been drawn from the Francophone members of the parliament by the sheer weight of the majority vote in the parliament. And the Anglophones were saying that was not fair, there must be a rotation, and the next, this year, it should be an Anglophone country producing the leadership. The response of the Francophone members were that there's no such principle in the organization of the Pan-African Parliament. What this shows is that a disturbing system that emerged years and years ago has not been resolved. As is known, the issue of rotation is a diplomatic principle which has been observed regularly at the United Nations and in many diplomatic settings. Because there is a kind of disturbance or suspicion between the two groups that began way back before many Africans achieved their independence. In 1958, when President de Gaulle put before the Francophone Africans the issue of a French community, only Secretary of Guinea deferred and declared its independence. And that was the first time that Africans saw the cleavage between Anglophone and Francophone Africans. During the Congo crisis of 1960-64, many Francophone Africans tended to side with France, and this enabled some to defeat the great nationalist leader of the Congo in support of the independence of a section of the Congo. And we have seen it in issue after issue after issue in the United Nations. In the time of the apartheid system, there was this kind of cleavage. Recently, we have seen that the issue of a common currency in West Africa was hampered by the Francophones' alliance with France in using the French system of currency, the euro. And even though 2 years ago, there was an attempt to have a new one called ECHO, it has just been announced 2 weeks ago that that too is in difficulty. The real issue that Africans have to face is this. After 60 years of independence, why are Africans being allowed to divide themselves on linguistic terms, particularly languages that belong to the colonial powers long, long, long time ago? We cannot allow this to continue because Africa needs unity. And it is really a shame that we are in 2021 and we are still fighting over Anglophone and Francophone. This is a time for an urgent meeting between the leaders and for them to agree that they should submerge these linguistic difficulties and look at the common objective that Africa surely needs now in Africa. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Coming for me. tell them, blaze them. Look at you in that dress. Girl, you dangerous like a gun. Give them you nothing less. Girl, you murder everyone. Your love is a killer. Your love is a killer. Hey, look at you. So cool. So cool. If you ain't ready, then you need to go for home. Everywhere, I just see her running on a solo. Solo. She got me begging, hold up. And she all up on me like a logo. Logo. But I'm not complaining. My baby, let's go, go, go. She kill her when I dance, she better with the waist. Everybody watch her when she turn up in the place. You ain't got a chance if you really tryna race. She already had a finish line with her face. I showed her went down, then she went low. Gave it to her battle like she in a relay. The craziest thing is she don't know how beautiful she is every day.
Ninge ondoka kama mapenzi yako izo pero zako.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Bill Eagle, Reporter Douglas Impuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a herbalist that refuses to ask laymen what leaves he looks for in the bush must have difficulties getting what he wants. I'm your host, Peter Clotet in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.